This is the Behave Yourself Podcast, a podcast about behavioral science in the Global South, brought to you by the Busara Center for Behavioral Economics. I'm your host, Linda Kimaru. This is the final episode in our misinformation series. So far, we've talked about the ways misinformation can have a devastating impact on public order and what fact-checking looks like in the Global South, especially right now in the midst of a pandemic. Today, our research manager at Busara, Lorna, is back.
We're continuing the conversation on misinformation. So far, we've talked to various...
And she's moderating a conversation with Busarians Magdalena, a research specialist, and Grace, a project associate, along with other external friends, Angela, the founder and coach at Triple Bottom Line Associates, and Gospel, a research and development economist at Streetnomics based in Nigeria. Here is episode 7 of Behave Yourself, Misinformation from the Consumer's Perspective.
As I mentioned, today we're talking about misinformation. And as you all know, we access information from all sorts of platforms. We have Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, WhatsApp. And quite frankly, the nature of how information has been spread today and is delivered has evolved over the years thanks to the rise of technology and social media. But why should we as consumers care about misinformation in our day-to-day age? Angie, I'll start with you. What kind of a consumer are you?
I'm probably the content creator's worst consumer. I'm the kind of consumer that is very, very, very specific about what I choose to consume. I've been burnt a couple of times or just disheartened by the quality of information that's out there, the amount of misinformation that's out there. And so I'm the kind of consumer that chooses to not consume too much information, particularly that which is being disseminated on social media platforms. And so I'm usually a little bit late to the game with hearing about what's going on, especially for fresh news. But the interesting thing about news cycles or information cycles is that everything just comes back around. And so I hear it very often from third parties, from WhatsApp groups, from my mother, who likes to send me a lot of information, even some that is fake. But yeah, I'm the kind of consumer that is very, very, very cynical around what's out there.
And what about you, Gosto?
Okay, so I am very, maybe also due to the nature of my work and bias as a research economist from Nigeria, I'm very keen on the credibility of the information. And the quality of information also, you know, so I wouldn't want to use myself as a basis to explain the average Nigerian consumer. There's so much difference in terms of information consumption gap and the like. So as we go ahead, I would likely speak more on their end, but I, as a person, I'm very careful about information. Credibility is very important for me. Source is very important for me. The quality and the depth of analytical utility from that information is very important to me. And I'm also very careful how I use information in the public space and how I disseminate information in the public space. Knowing fully well the information consumption appetite of the average Nigerian. So, yeah.
So depending on the kind of consumer we are, why should we care about misinformation, Magdalena?
Yeah, I think misinformation can sometimes be harmless. Depends on what the topic is, right? The incentives for creating fake news can be, I think, monetary in the sense of these like provocative banners and like clickbait headlines to make users visit the website and just get like some advertising revenue. So basically selling ads or directly promoting the selling of a product, like what happened with the promotion of hydroxychloroquine mm-hmm. and as a COVID prevention. Yeah, so the political side would be like people and groups promoting their own ideas, their own views through video messages, pictures, interviews, and newspaper to provide false claims that support their own views. And I think it's important as a starting point to think why someone might want to spread fake news or start them in the first place. And then we can obviously be critical about it when we see one of these like striking headlines.
Right. Angie, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. How can we as consumers, when we think about the different key players that are there, regardless of their incentive, how can we as consumers at least know or take note, fact check and take note of the information that we are consuming on a daily basis?
I think, and I'm going to speak very much from an African context, and recognizing that this is different in different parts of the continent as well. There is a shortage of fact-checking platforms or methodologies, right? So if I talk about my approach to it, it's as simple as understanding the credibility of the source, right? So where does most of the information we get today come from? Newspapers are, I don't know the last time somebody actually bought a newspaper. So you're either looking at the newspaper's online platform. And in most cases, at least from in Kenya, there are certain newspapers that you know have a certain amount of editorial credibility that they will not be positioning very fake news. I use very fake news because the number of retractions and apologies that they still have to issue, in my opinion, is still quite significant. But then the bulk of the information that people are consuming really comes from social media platforms, right? So your Facebooks, your Twitters, Instagram, Reddit, YouTube, and most of that content is actually could be generated by anybody. Mm-hmm. And so for me, whenever I see that content, first of all, it's to go back to the internet and check and see, is there anything that I consider to be a relatively credible source that has talked about the same thing? So that would mean that you would have to know which platforms are more inclined to tabloid or Garter Press type information than the ones that are more serious. And then I think the second thing is, you know, communication. The reality is we still are very much a word of mouth, an informal structure or social structure, information dissemination culture, right? Yeah. So you know, talking to other people, especially those that you know are experts in the field, which might sound very, very tedious, but the alternatives, I think what Magdalena was making reference to, like if we look at the hydrochloroquine situation, the alternatives, like you could risk your life, you could be sick and you could die if you don't actually take the time to confirm what information is out there. And I think the last thing I was going to say is, while there is some importance on the consumer to check, for me, the responsibility on those that are creating the content, especially those that are not so motivated by the financial element that Magdalena was outlining, or the power and political elements, people who are just creating content for the sake of creating content, there's a huge responsibility on them. Because now, especially, there are a lot of laws that are coming out about, you know, passing on of information that is not acceptable, that is considered to be hate speech, that is considered to be misinformation. You can get into significant trouble around that. So there's responsibility both on the consumer side and the content creator side.
What are your thoughts on this, Gospel? Like, do you think that we as consumers, is there a social or psychological reason as to why we're so vulnerable to misinformation?
The idea of misinformation for the Nigerian, from the Nigerian consumer's perspective, is an interplay between the cluster deficits that exist around the sociocultural dynamics. So let me explain that. For instance, number one, we are largely a quote-unquote qualitative people. We are driven by stories, we are driven by feelings, we are driven by emotions, you know, we are driven by rumors and gists. And all of these things shape our ideologies, our perception, even to a very large extent, our judgment about how we interact with goods and services, how we make decisions to vote for who. You know, in 2019, during Nigerian elections, these are part of the things I spoke about, talking about alternative facts and how it shapes consumer or voters, sorry, electorate perception to voting and all that. You know, so we are largely very qualitative people, and we do not have enough context feeds let me say, use the word consumer education in terms of empowering people as to how to make the right decision using data. You know, so there's a huge education gap, you know, and there is also training is inadequate in terms of context fit training on how to develop the right information, how to deploy information, that's the right information, and even how to use or consume the right information. All right. There's also a challenge around training capacity. I'm trying to break down the sociocultural dynamics now that leads to the cluster deficit. There's also an issue of training capacity. So it means that an individual can know a thing so well that he or she is not open to how that thing can be done in a better way or in another way. All right. So you believe this thing is right in this particular way, and that's all there is to it. So we're not a flexible people that are willing to learn or see things from other people's perspective, you know, and all that. There's also there's a poor fusion between the academia and the professional practice. All right. So what happens is, because the professional practice want to do things on their own and there's lack of that fusion, and they look at, they perceive the academia as too theoretical and not pragmatic. All right. And then the academia perceives the industry guys as, in quote unquote, pragmatic, but lacks the absence of theoretical application to their research, that use of models and all that. You know, so there's also a non-inclusivity of young people in the right information space. So you see a lot of young people opening blogs, doing rumors, trying to jump on the next trend and all that. So young people are not really involved in the hard and rigorous process of, you know, defining the right information, putting the right information out there. So a cluster of all of these pockets of deficits here and there, you know, is what has informed and empowered our already existing cultural appetite for stories, rumors, gist, and all that. So these social cultural dynamics, I'm trying to say that they're quite deep and they exist in different root causes, you know, when we look at them further down on that decision tree and the like. So it's a cluster of all of these things that has made the misinformation space what it is, especially in Africa and in Nigeria. So if we're going to fix things or try and rework consumer information and all that, and ensuring that we deal with the challenge of misinformation, then we need to deal with all of these things from the cluster angle, you know, as it pertains to the sociocultural dynamics of misinformation.
It's time for a quick break and your behavioral science term of the week. In this episode, you hear Magdalena talk about how researchers can conflate causation or correlation. This is known as statistical fallacy, which is when we misuse statistics to assert a falsehood, either on purpose or accidentally. In most cases, such as in the examples you've heard about the incentives of spreading false information, statistical fallacy can be used for some kind of gain. That is your behavioral science term of the week. Now back to the episode.
So I want to come back to you, Grace. So based on what we're hearing about the impact of some of these social cultural norms, right? What can we do, or are there key players when we're thinking about maybe the research community or government or media agencies, what can we do to kind of break down those practices and actually make people be able to speak up or be able to question some of the information that they receive or they consume?
I think before I talk about the different actors, so government and media houses, I think I want to take a step back and look at the perspective of consumers and what role they play in terms of tackling misinformation. And one thing that came to mind was this aspect of evaluating every information that you come across before sharing it, right? And just to put it into more context is, think about a witness that is put on the stand to recount an incident that happened. More often than not, the questioning technique is always about, what can you remember? Give me as much information as possible. And less about, feel free to withhold any information that you're either not comfortable sharing or you feel may bring inconsistencies to your story, right? And the same concept and the same mindset, I think, should be brought about when consuming information, right? So if you are exposed to an article or any form of mass media, similar to what Angie had said before, is one, you need to question the information that you get, right? You need to ask yourself, does it conform to my worldview? Are there any inconsistencies in the information that I've been exposed to? Then at that point, once you start questioning it, then one, you'll be able to help yourself avoid consuming information that is inconsistent or doesn't seem true. And two, also prevents you sharing that information to other people, because through sharing it is how we spread misinformation.
So I have a quick question for you. I loved everything that you said. That the one question that I have for you and anybody else, actually, maybe Gosto, you can jump in here. Is it really easy for vulnerable groups to fact check?
I think, first of all, it starts from, if we look at it from a private sector perspective, I mentioned a few points that that I defined as cluster deficits, you know. These are cluster deficits that shape the need or that lead to misinformation. So the structural, that sociocultural perspective of what leads to misinformation. So I think, first of all, we need to fix all of that, because the vulnerable, in the sense, it is information that gets to them. So there's still a part of what the vulnerable needs to do or how we need to present information to the vulnerable. But first of all, we need to deal with these cluster deficits, right, that even shape the kind of information that goes up in the first place. Cluster deficits around context fit training, dealing with the training capacity, like Grace talked about worldviews and all the likes. I mean, I even in the technical space, I see a lot of researchers try to understand and interpret data from their worldview. You know, so they may not be aware of it, but that's already a bias that comes into the analysis of that data. All right, you know, so those are things that individuals who are in the technical space need to be open to other ways and other worldviews and trying to look at information from different lenses. All right, how do I look at information as an economist, as a branding professional, and all of these things? Then, like I mentioned earlier on, the poor fusion between the academia and the professional practice. So all of these things, you know, from the private sector end needs to be fixed. There needs to be quality training. There needs to be more collaboration in the use of information. There needs to be interdisciplinary collaborations, more like it. So even if you're working on an economic policy now, you should have a health professional on board. You should have an economist on board. You should have a statistician on board. You should have, you know, people that represent different technical angles, all right, to ensure that the policy is richer, you know, in terms of engagement and the like. So I think we first need to sort all these things from a private sector angle. Now, from the public sector angle, the government needs to be more, there needs to be a political will, right, to churn out the right information. So, for instance, there are situations where the GDP data may be less than what is being quoted, or maybe more than what is being quoted. So what we find in the reports can be overestimated figure or an underestimated figure for some political reasons, you know, and the like. So I think we need to be a little bit more accountable, all right, and provide the right information. Now, where am I going to? All of these things tie up to the information that is being made available to the vulnerable groups. The vulnerable groups may have access to digital platforms or not, or even the conventional newspaper platforms, right? Traditional platforms, I mean. But it is the information that pops up or that they see, that they literally consume. All right, so from the back end, in trying to control these things, we need to work more on the quality of information that comes out there. Even from a regulatory perspective, institutionally wise, right? Institutional capacity has to be upgraded to ensure that people are delivering the right information and the likes. So all of these things, first of all, has to be done. Then secondly, how does the vulnerable groups consume information? So for instance, for the poor or for the rural people in the environment, they consume information mostly by conventional text messages, right? By word of mouth, by hearsay. You know, how do we improve the quality of word of mouth spread? You know, by all of these things. For the elderly now, probably they have access to newspapers and the like. So how do we improve the channels through which they consume this information and how the information is presented to them? What's their information appetite? You know, that's another thing we need to look at. Are they people that would consume so much information at once, or they like to take information in bits, or they like to interact with information visually, or they like to interact with information through an audio podcast like this. So understanding the channels through which these different vulnerable groups, because it can't be a one-size-fits-all, all right? These channels per vulnerable group will determine how information will be best disseminated to them. Also knowing fully well that the vulnerable groups can also, so like Gracie was talking about information appetite and how we deliver this information to them. We understand that some level of information for some vulnerable groups can also be provocative, you know? So even in the midst of trying to provide the right information to them, we also want to be careful that the information is not in excess, that it becomes provocative. So we need to understand the world views, all right? The information channels, the information appetite, the perception of these different vulnerable group segments, all right, to determine in the first place the quality of information that goes to them and how this information would be better transmitted for them to understand and appreciate and even use. Yeah.
Yes. Thanks, Gospel. I think I agree with a lot of what you're saying. It's really, really important to do good research and understand which are the channels that vulnerable populations are using to get all their information, all their media and news. But what is going to be really tricky is once we know these channels, it's usually lots of layers between the research, the academic research that's conducted that gets to facts or reliable conclusions, to actually arriving to this vulnerable population. So it might be that there's just like many, many steps through which this information is disseminated. And by the time that it reaches the population, it will be completely distorted. So what do people think about what's the best way, for instance, if we're thinking of a rural area in Western Kenya, and we think about their channel is the local radio. How, like, where are these the local radio presenters getting their information from, and where do, like, how does this go upwards until the actual source of information, the first source? What would you add there to actually tackle this issue of these multiple layers of information until it reaches the final consumer?
That's fantastic. I love where this conversation is going. Grace, did you have something to add when we're thinking about vulnerable populations and not just how they receive information, that to Magdalena's point, you know, how they also take part in spreading information?
I want to give an example from one of the projects that I've been working on for a while now. And from our experience is the thing with mass media, so radio or TV, it's really hard to control the kind of information that goes out, especially when it's information on current affairs because of political vested interests, right? But then there are other topics, for example, like health topics, where you can work together with authority leaders like clinics to help disseminate that information. And giving an example is, so with COVID and the fact that most of us were isolated and we couldn't move around, most of the vulnerable populations are working with, so think of adolescent girls and young women, most of them could not access their refills for this HIV prevention drug that we've been working on. And so most of them were either just decided to stop using it, or they had all these questions on how they can access it and would end up asking their friends, and they'd end up getting wrong information. So what we did was to partner with the clinics, where we would frame messaging on where they can access these pills during the COVID period, and then use their peer educators. So peer educators are the ones that work closely with these vulnerable populations to disseminate that information through mostly WhatsApp or Facebook and Instagram. And The importance of that is by working closely with these authority figures in this community, then it's possible to get the right information to them and at the right time. And if I bring it back to current affairs, maybe it could be working with chiefs or religious leaders in sort of like controlling the narrative that's going out. So for example, there was a clash in a given village. Instead of people going to hear it from the radio or passing rumor mongering around the village, then you can work with village elders and religious leaders to control that narrative and ensure that the message that is being passed out is the right information.
I love what you just said, because one of the things that popped into my mind when thinking about vulnerable groups is particularly, so in the work that I do around diversity, equity and inclusion, it also looks at, for example, people living with disabilities and how do they access information or tools, right? So if you think about using very, very formal channels for media, then we're relying on those formal channels to be able to provide alternative access for people who are not able to. So let's say somebody who is hard of hearing or deaf, and they would need a sign language interpreter. So if the media house or there is no closed captioning or the official channels of information have not invested in making sure that all the information is accessible, then that individual, whether they are blind, deaf, or any other form of disability, would have to rely on a third or fourth party, right? Who then, and if I think about it in terms of COVID times, you know, how do you explain a lot of the information around hand washing and using a mask and sanitizing and all this stuff to somebody who hasn't ever seen some of these things? You're relying on their caregiver, who you hope then has enough time, but it really doesn't allow them to access the information independently. So anyone creating content really needs to think about the informal channels that are very, very, very powerful, and create content, or I think you said frame messages, that would ensure that the right information, even though broken telephone happens, gets as close to the consumer as possible. It made me think about when we were doing when Kenya was doing its constitution review process. For those who might not be familiar with it, there was a banana, which was the yes symbol for those who wanted the constitutional referendum to go through. And then there was an orange, which was for those who were in the no camp. Now, because of tribal and ethnic polarization of politics, the majority of Kenyans didn't actually read the actual constitution document. They just made reference to oranges and bananas and quoted whichever political leader that they trusted. And they would say, you know, so-and-so has read it and they said it's bad, so then we're just going to vote no. So understanding that you cannot say that we provided information in a huge constitutional document, you had to understand where were the power plays and how do you penetrate vulnerable groups, informal communities, those who don't have the same levels of literacy that that is ideal for consuming information. How do you speak their language? Because oftentimes it's not even a goal to be making it false news or fake news, but it's actually because the channels are not, like, literally they're not speaking the same language as
it's
those
time
that
for
are consuming
a quick break. When we come back, the guests talk about where the responsibility lies in ensuring that information reaches the consumer as intended and what regulation could potentially look like. We'll be right back.
Are there other players? Is it the media outlets? Is it the people who run some of these social media platforms? Who else has a key role in at least ensuring that information, by the time it's conceived to when it's spread out and delivered, doesn't get broken and doesn't get twisted?
I think it's always going to get broken and twisted to some extent. Like, that's just the nature of distance, right, from the source to the consumer. So maybe on the one hand, there's also a conversation around reducing the number of stops between the creator and the consumer. But I think, and I'm saying this in a very hesitant manner, because I'm not really about heavy policing or censorship. I think there's something super powerful about being able to disseminate information freely, but there is a responsibility that comes with that. And one of my perspectives is, and I'm sure you guys work at Busara and all your understanding around behavior will probably agree with me, is that there's something about teaching the right behavior to individuals at a much earlier stage, right? This is not something we're going to fix tomorrow, but simple things like the value of truth, right? The responsibility that we have as citizens, as, you know, fellow human beings on this earth to take care of one another. When we were kids, you told a lie and you knew what would happen to you if you told a lie, right? It just feels now there are no consequences to deliberately, I don't know if you can say deliberately disinforming the consumer, but to deliberately putting disinformation out there. There are no consequences because all you do is you put a statement, you retract it, you say, oh, my bad. I don't know, you delete the post. The other day I was looking at a blog post and then 2 days later the blog post has been deleted. But everything in that blog post was disinformation. So without suggesting that we should police and over-censor information that's being put out there, my question, and this comes also from my background, is what are we doing about ensuring that we're instilling the right level of value or values in our general population, but particularly with our youth, to ensure that they understand the responsibility and the impact or the effect of putting out information that is fake, that is harmful, that is targeting. And we can go into like super deep conversations about even things like online bullying and how that happens. And it's not necessarily because of the individual, but it's about how they're being positioned in what you've called disinformation. So for me, I'll always bring it back down to how we as human beings develop, the element of human capital development, talent development, what are we teaching as values, what is our culture saying? And now the craziness around there or around that is we have such a, like you can't do the same thing in Kenya as you would do in Nigeria, as you would necessarily do in Zimbabwe, because our cultural realities are so different. But at a baseline, we need to get back to the ethics and the values and the morals of our society without over-policing it. That's my perspective. And I don't think it stops with the researchers.
And I think this is a really interesting debate, and maybe for another occasion, but about like how much should, for instance, the government regulate the social media platforms. This has been like a huge debate in the US about Facebook and the elections and how this is affecting and yeah, where's the liability there? Is it Facebook? Is it the people posting? Is it the consumers that believe everything? Shouldn't we just like leave everything to the consumer's judgment? And yeah, that's a very, very interesting point. And then going back to research and researchers, I would say, at least in economics, it's not very used that the researchers themselves disseminate their research. The researchers try to influence policy, yes, but not necessarily up to when it reaches consumers. What happens here is that a researcher can, yeah, publish a paper, and then they can maybe some media platforms will reach out and like and be like, there's this really great media platforms like Vox or The Economist that try to make research like easier to read for the everyday user, but still this is not gonna be enough.
Don't you believe that we need to kind of police, it's not brutal policing, the kind of police in some way, or regulate is a better word, regulate who is out there, who is getting factual, relevant, evidenced information from the research end or from a clean end, like Magdalena is saying, and who is delivering it? Don't we need to do some sort of regulation? Gosto?
I think, to be very honest with you, we can deal with this issue from 2 to 3 parts. First of all, there has to be, because even the regulators that want to get this thing right, they are not appropriately trained and they don't have the capacity. Because you'd be shocked that individuals and clusters who are intentionally disinforming people, all right, have so much resources, they are well skilled, and they have access. So they are probably 5 steps ahead of the conventional research community. regulators themselves have to be empowered, they have to be trained, and they have to be given the right capacity, institutional capacity, to be able to make decisions. Then there has to be legal / disciplinary measures for disinformation. But on the other side of things, research committees also need to step up their game to deliver the right information. And quite honestly, I think that the research community going forward needs to play in the bigger picture of information provision, even to the final consumer.
And thus ends episode 7. Huge thanks to all the guests for being on the podcast and sharing their great insights. If you haven't listened yet, you can hear the first 2 episodes of this 3-part series on misinformation, and we've linked all those episodes in the notes. Behave Yourself is a production of the Bousara Center for Behavioral Economics. Find us on Twitter at Bousara Center and read more about the work that we do on the Bousara blog on Medium. Until next time, remember, behave yourself.